Meeting please come to order. First we'll have our invocation and we have a hopefully a special treat this morning. Suzanne Spalding, one of our students, is going to give the invocation. Suzanne?
That you'll give wisdom to every person here or this board of regents who will be making decisions for this university. And Lord, I just pray that you'll give them the thoughts and the words and the actions to just make these decisions for the best of the community and this university and this community. And I just want to thank you so much for all the hands, the hours, the sweat and the hard work that every single employee, Lord, puts into this university every day, Lord, to make it function. And Lord, thank you so much for all the thousands and thousands of people this university has touched, Lord. All the alumni, students, family, Lord, and they're just so proud to call them to get you at home. And Lord, I want to furthermore pray for the students, Lord, that we will just be given everything that we need, Lord, here at this university to reach our full potential, Lord, and just go out into our communities and in this world, Lord, and become emerging generations. And Lord, thank you so much for allowing us to be here at this amazing university, Lord, where each individual spirit makes a master. Through your name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
If the board would indulge with me for a second, I'd like to read a short bio of Suzanne. She's from Marion County, my home county. Suzanne is currently a junior in the Honors College, majoring in chemistry and Spanish on a pre-orthotic and prosthetics track. She holds a position in the Honors College as an administrative student assistant, as well as being a previous honors topper. This year, Suzanne is the Baptist Campus Ministry Worship Band Leader, considering music as her spiritual gift. She also participates at the Catholic Campus Center and was given the opportunity to be a Governor's Scholars Program Resident Assistant this past summer. Suzanne is again from Marion County, Kentucky, where she graduated from high school in 2009 and loves to retreat to ride her horses. Suzanne was our 2009 Marion County Junior Miss. She placed in the top 10 in the Marion County Junior Miss competition. If you can get Suzanne away from the library, she enjoys having fun with best friends, met here at WKU, taking frequent trips to the Great American Donut Shop, loving life as a WKU student.
How about you?
A couple other items this morning before we get started. We want to congratulate Dr. Minner on her re-election and staying with us on the board for another 3 years. Congratulations, here. Patty.
And also, if I might, Mr. Chair, let me add one thought to that. Certainly, Patty is to be congratulated for 57.25% of the vote among faculty. And equally impressive is the fact that 517 faculty participated in the faculty region election, which is 67% of eligible faculty voters. And if you follow elections at all, you know that is an impressive turnout and impressive participation. This tells you a lot about the degree to which our faculty are engaged in important matters across this campus. So congratulations to Patty, and congratulations to our faculty as well. And I want to compliment Pam Petty and Scott Lasley and Dr. Stark for Sharon Stark for participating in this election. And we had four outstanding candidates that were candidates, and that's exactly the way an important election like a faculty region election should be. So, well done.
On one other note, all of you got word that Regent Zilke had some surgery and is, I understand, recovering nicely. The board did send him a planner, and Larry called Julia earlier in the week and wanted to ask her to pass along to each board member appreciation for thinking of him. So our thoughts and prayers go out to Larry Zilke. And next, it's oath of office time. Do we swear in our newest regent? Ms. Harris, are you ready?
Solemnly swear that you will support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the Commonwealth and be faithful and true to the Commonwealth of Kentucky so long as you continue a citizen thereof, and that you will faithfully execute to the best of your ability the office of member of the Board of Regents of Western Kentucky University according to law. And you further solemnly swear that since the adoption of the present Constitution, you being a citizen of the state, and not fall a duel with deadly weapons within the state, nor out of it, nor have you sent or accepted a challenge to fight a duel with deadly weapons, nor have you acted as second in carrying a challenge, or aided or assisted any person thus appointed. So help you God.
You're not through yet.
Cynthia, welcome to the Board of Regents, and welcome back into an active life in your university. One of the traditions we have as a Board of Regents is that several years ago we had commissioned a Board of Regents pen. And this pen is modeled after the WKUC Durant. And it is special only for Regents, and only members of serving this board will have one of these pens. And we hope you will wear it proudly and with distinction and honor. And it's a pleasure to present this to you and welcome you to the Board of Regents. And we'd like both to comment on the day and day. Congratulations.
Regent Meyer has asked for the floor for just a second, so I'll...
Thank you, sir. I know many of you have heard and read, and many of you knew Mr. Lewis Mills, who was our athletic director here prior to Wood Selig, and it goes back to the time of Ross, when Ross first worked here. Ross worked for Lewis when he was first here, and I wanted to make mention of Lewis. He had passed last week and was certainly a really good personal friend of mine, and I know that many of you knew him and thought well of him also, so I wanted to recognize Lewis.
But add to that last Saturday we buried one of our most distinguished faculty, as far as I'm concerned, in the history of this institution, Lowell Harrison, who was the patriarch of the discipline of history in Kentucky, and many would concur with that as well across the state. And he was an extensively published scholar, and in fact wrote the definitive history of this university that he published in 1987. And Lowell is survived by his wife Penny, who lives in an assisted living facility in Owensboro, where her family is near. But it was an honor for me to get to know him as a student, as a young administrator, and certainly over the last 14 years in a renewed friendship with Lowell Harrison. I know Patty and colleagues in the history department feel this loss as well.
Dr. Harrison was also, to add to his list of many things that he did in a life well lived, he was also the first faculty regent, first person to serve on the board in that capacity.
I knew he was a regent, didn't know he was the first one.
Two
about
terms.
That?
He was pathbreaker.
I'll call the secretary for roll call.
Ms. Cynthia Harris. Mr. Freddie Higdon.
Here.
Mr. Jim Johnson.
Here.
Mr. James Kennedy.
Here.
Mr. Jim Meyer.
Here.
Dr. Patricia Minter.
Here.
Mr. David Porter.
Here.
Mr. Billy Stevens.
Here.
Mr. Rob Wilkins. And Mr. Larry Zelke.
We have a quorum. You have before you the agenda. First item is approval of the special budget meeting minutes of June 24, 2011. Are there any additions or corrections to those minutes? Without objection, they are approved. Next item, third quarterly meeting minutes of July 29, 2011. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? Without objection, they're approved by consensus. Next turn to the Academic Affairs Committee, Dr. Dennison.
Before we get started, I think Gordon had some introductions to make.
I do. Good morning. I'd like to start your morning with a quick astrophysics class. Pay attention. Think of it, gravity is an attractive force, and therefore it should be pulling everything together so that after a certain amount of time, everything will be collapsed into one point. Well, if you look outside on this beautiful morning, that obviously hasn't happened yet. And one of the resolutions of this happened in the early 1900s when Edwin Hubble, after whom the Hubble Space Telescope is named, discovered that the universe started in a big bang and has expanding ever since. But at least, surely, it should be decelerating, slowing down because of gravity, but it turns out it's not. It's accelerating. And in fact, this year's Nobel Prize in Physics was recently awarded jointly to Saul Perlmutter, Brian Schmidt, and Adam Riess for, and I quote, the discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe through observations of distant supernovae. Now, this means there is some form of repulsive force out there which goes by the somewhat macabre name of dark energy. It's something we still don't fully understand, but we do know, as a result of its discovery, that the universe will expand forever until it dies what's called a cold death. Heavy stuff. But we at WKU are very proud that our own Lou Strolger, a professor in our Department of Physics and Astronomy, was involved in this pivotal discovery. To give you some idea of the scope of Lou's involvement in this work, a pivotal 2004 paper by Adam Riess, Lou Strolger, and others has been cited no less than 2,251 times as of this morning. It has been read, i.e. opened electronically, 3,918 times, including over 1,000 times in 2006 alone. Lou was also lead author on a 2004 paper with Riess et al., which has been cited 151 times, and the sole co-author with one of the Nobel Prize winners on one of the papers in 2006. I'm very pleased to recognize Lou Strolger, who's accompanied today by Department Head Keith Andrew and Associate Dean Bruce Kessler, and invite Lou to say a few words to the board. Lou.
Thank you. It's quite an honor to be here, and I'm very pleased. Let me just say that obviously the Nobel Prize in Physics this year was won by Dr. Perlmutter of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, Dr. Schmidt of Australian National Laboratory, and Dr. Riess of Johns Hopkins University. The prize was largely for this, as Dr. Emsley has already pointed out, the discovery that the universe is accelerating and its expansion. Prior to this discovery, the paradigm was that we live in a matter field universe, where gravity dictated what the past, present, and future will be. Too much, and the universe will collapse upon itself. Too little, and it'll expand forever. Just the right amount, and it'll expand in a very graceful way. The goal in the 1990s was to actually determine how much the universe was decelerating under its own weight, and to measure the motion in several epochs in the past using very precise tools known as Type 1a supernovae. The 98, the scientists and their teams came to a very surprising conclusion. The universe was not slowing down at all. It was speeding up. To do so, the universe has to have a very large, presently unseen, repellent force, a very overwhelming force that's acting opposite to gravity. And with no apologies to Star Wars, we decided to call this dark energy. But extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. Reese and myself devised a rather simple test of this very new cosmology, and that is, if the universe is accelerating now, it may not necessarily have done so in the past. So we sought out to use our most powerful telescope, the Hubble Space Telescope, to look for and measure Type 1a supernovae in the very, very distant past. We began the study. I was Adam Reese's very, very first postdoc and hired to manage the survey. By 2004, we were able to show that the dark energy interpretation was very much indeed correct. The universe did recently transform from being a matter-dominated universe to a dark energy accelerating universe, actually very quite recently, a mere 5 billion years ago. Now that we are certain that dark energy exists, our job has really just begun. We're left in a universe where there's no very clear theoretical framework of why we have dark energy. I should say, rather, that there are thousands of equally unpleasant explanations as to why dark energy could exist, and none are a clear leader. We can ask rather simple questions like, what is it doing now, and what was it doing in the past, to try to narrow in on its nature. And just the last year, we have embarked on a very new, fantastic study looking to measure an unprecedented number of Type 1a supernovae in this deceleration phase to get a handle of how dark energy has evolved. This project has been the single largest program ever awarded with Hubble, and we hope that it will shine light on this very dark mystery. And if you have any technical questions, please ask Dr. Emslie, who's right next to you. Thank you.
Fascinating.
To have a member of our faculty so closely involved in the awarding of a Nobel Prize is really remarkable, and Lou certainly is among our distinguished faculty, and that's validated by our students and his colleagues in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. And congratulations. Your words kind of make things like enrollments and budget seem rather inconsequential, but congratulations, Lou. Well done, sir.
That's wonderful. I'm so thrilled to hear about that. Let's go on to action items 1.1, if you want to go to page 1 through 3 of your syllabus. We've discussed these at length. Is there any questions about number 1.1, which is approval of a graduate certificate in adult education? Right, can we just go ahead and approve it?
Yeah, did you get one with consent?
Are there any items under Academic Affairs Committee that a board member wishes to remove for discussion? I guess if not, we proceed to Executive Committee.
Well, we do have information items, but we do need action to approve the consent agenda, do we?
I move we approve
the consent agenda. We had decided we would kind of phase this in, and so what I presented to the chair is an outline, and we'll go through each committee, and if there's any board member that wishes to remove an item for discussion, it'll be removed. Those that aren't removed, we'll hold, go through each committee, and then we'll vote in one vote on those items that are not removed from the consent agenda.
Do we have the information items?
No, it's all one thing.
So we'll get rid of the action items first. Okay.
So if there is a board member that wants to discuss an information item, it can be removed.
So that being said, there was no indication from a board member to remove an academic affairs action item. So next we'll move to the action items under the executive committee.
Do we not want to do the information items?
I think we're going to come back and pick those up. Is that right, Debbie?
If someone wishes to discuss them.
But we'll come back and get the information items next, right?
You can do them now.
should do it now.
Just do it and get
Dan will change change administrative council members.
Can we go ahead and do enrollment report with Dr. Mears?
Yes. Especially Vice President Merida.
Hand up. Float those around, please.
Yep.
Following up, we have to enrollment is growing and standing at a moderate and graceful pace.
There you go.
All right.
It's nice way for saying that we are not down, but we are moving up and forward. We're heading in a decent direction. For an enrollment officer, that's always a safe thing. But seriously, all seriousness, what you have there before you is a snapshot of this week's enrollment. At committee meetings, we sort of alluded to where we were heading. The census date is coming up next Wednesday, which I believe is the 26th, where we report official enrollment. But the good news in all of this is that we are following drop for non-payments and subsequent reinstatements of our students. I'll point out just a few numbers here for you. Freshmen this fall, we're looking at 3,180 versus the 3,156 from 2010, so that's up 24. You can come down the line, other particular areas of interest. Navitas is up at, says actually 45, 65 students. This snapshot is taken on Monday. 65 is where a Navitas undergraduate and 7 graduate. That's very promising. That's a triple from its original numbers. And we're working with Navitas to do some projections over the next couple of years here to show Randall and the board kind of where that's going. We're doing a paper on that actually as of early next week. The numbers I'm going to point you out for in the middle under continuing, where you see the negative, the negative 134 and 130 freshmen to sophomore year. Again, I mentioned that because this is where the MAP work, software and applications for retention that we're putting forward, working with food affairs, residence life, and looking at the non-cognitive factors, homesick, financial, roommate problems, those sorts of things. Why students in the freshman sophomore year may or may not be, it may or not be returning. And we're very optimistic that will give us direction on how to do our programming. The first go-around of the MapWorks application, we had almost a 60% participation, 4%, I believe, which is very, very, very good for a survey of students, particularly us freshmen. We're pretty busy. And then from there, we'll work with the affairs and off-campus new programming. But I guess if you all boil it all down, the good news is that enrollment is in good shape, and we believe all indicators seem to point to next Wednesday, we could very well be at 21,000 students with the reinstatement.
And last year, our final census number was 2,903.
We are already 34 beyond that, and it will only get better.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Won't go down and go up, so
Yeah, Dr. Meredith, what was the, you said that you're reinstating, but what was the drop number for non-payment? And second question is, how does that compare to previous years?
Let's see, that earlier this week, last fall we dropped 338, and compared to 60 this year, these are from the registrar. The total of 331 students have been reinstated thus far, which is pretty good. Below as our dual credit to high school, they will have some activity over the next few days.
I think the original number that we mentioned first, I think we dropped 975 students initially.
So this is the net number.
Yeah,
so
and that was a lower number than we dropped for non-payment last year, and we indicated this at the committee meetings that we suspect the initial, what looked like a low enrollment, may in fact be students who would have been dropped anyway. Almost immediately, 400 of those students reinstated. At this point, we're within about 150 or so. give us the cosmologists to graphs with us. Seriously, the institutional research folks looking at the trend are projecting a preliminary number, preliminary only, of 21061.
Okay.
If current trends continue.
Understand that sometimes it's, we're almost two-thirds of the way through the semester, so sometimes it's a little hard for the board to put some of these numbers in context, but you have to reach a point where students who have not yet paid simply have to be dropped from their classes, and it's a difficult circumstance for students and faculty and everybody involved, but there is a business aspect to this enterprise that has to be addressed, and invariably more than half of those that you drop, you end up reinstating within a matter of days because they found a way to come up with the money. Oh, you mean I really have to pay?
And some of the other half were never here.
That's right. And so a good portion of the half that are not reinstated never showed to begin with in late August. They may have paid a deposit and maybe even had a housing deposit and were enrolled in classes. But when you're dealing with an incoming class around numbers of 4,000 students and a total enrollment of 21,000, like any major complex organization, sometimes you just have to deal with the numbers. And so it's at this point that we can finally determine who will not be reinstated, and in many cases they're students that did not show in the first place. So this next week is when all that will be finally in the books, and we will have a final enrollment number, and that's just kind of the way those dynamics function in the complex world of enrollment management.
That 338, I think, was freshman, about 900 and some change. One thing that enrollment management is going to do to help the legal help this financial drop or non-payment sort of challenge is add to the orientation ATP session. Literacy financial conversations to that piece. To say, hey, here's the call, here's that work that you need to do. I don't know if that's happened and we're going to be in that business.
Let me add a couple of quick points here. As Brian indicated, we did initiate the MapWorks student survey. I had a turnout of that not quite equal to that for the Regents election, but still 57% of all freshmen participated in the survey, which is very impressive. 2,200 freshman students provided us a wealth of data with which we can move forward to identify at-risk students and implement strategies as appropriate. With our own folks in institutional research, I want to commend them for independently identifying groups of students in four categories: low, moderate, medium, and high risk, and that has been distributed to the departments in the hope that again we can identify students in need of some help and encourage them to be retained. So we're taking this initiative very seriously.
This survey not only is aimed at academic variables, but it may be principally aimed at non-academic variables that lead to the lack of persistence and students failing to persist and be retained and graduate. We know that more students leave us more for non-academic reasons than academic reasons that go from family to financial to homesickness to an hourly job that looks awfully attractive when you're 18 years old, and so we're trying to get a handle on all those variables that we can address that can improve our numbers in persistence, retention, and graduation.
MapWorks tells us that anyone there done a survey knows you get 57 whatever percentage. That's one. That's even higher from those who MapWorks has worked with, and in the residence halls, I believe it's even higher than that. It's they're close to 70 some odd. They're good policy reacting to that. They'll be important on board and making sure we can count the rather.
Sorry, I just had one more follow up question on that. So what is the follow up procedure? You said that the data's gone out to, from the initial survey's gone out to the departments, and we've talked about this a little bit at the University Senate, but now we're actually doing it. So what are we doing?
The MacWorks survey has not yet gone to departments.
Oh, it hasn't? Okay.
No, what's gone to departments is our own in-house assessment based on the variables that we identified as leading through a decision tree model to at-risk student. That data has been distributed largely based on the fifth week assessment information.
Right, right.
And we'll continue to refine that information internally when we, fall semester grade. The MacWorks information we're still assessing and trying to figure out what to do with it. Whether we distribute anything to departments this semester or not remains to be seen.
Got it. Okay, thanks.
Dr. Dennison had a question, I believe.
I can't follow the continuing, like for the freshmen. Where do you get your numbers for 2010-2011 if they're freshmen? So, I mean, so there was 3,000 first-time freshmen in 2010. So that class we would see as sophomores, that 2,797 of them came back this year. Is that how you're following that?
If they have completed 30 hours.
Oh.
So
where do you get the, how do you get the freshmen when it says continuing 1,475 under 2010?
These are people who came in, possibly part-time students who have not yet reached sophomore status and would be returning as freshmen.
Okay.
And that number has gone down, and that is a retention issue. So the two numbers for the retention are that -134 and -130. These are the
problems.
The essence of one of our largest retention issues, namely freshman to sophomore retention. We have to get more students continuing on to the sophomore year.
Once they get to sophomore, you see sophomore junior.
And this is a long-term trend.
If you could stay here, please. I'd like Brian to briefly report on several joint admissions agreements that we have with KCTCS institutions throughout the state.
WKU has a handful of these joint admissions agreements, and I think these are very promising for enrollment and just general relationships across the state with KCTCS schools. Our first one started in 2009 with Owensboro Community Technical College, and then recently we just did the BGTC and signed November 10th the newest agreement with BGTC. What schools across the country are doing with these joint admissions is more and more students, for a variety of reasons, are looking at their two-year regional community colleges. These agreements help us work with the two-year schools and their students. It allows their students access to the four-year institution, our services, advisors, different things of that nature, builds relationships. If there is a trend out there of freshmen, graduating high school, seniors in Kentucky may be waning or getting to a plateau point, these transfer numbers will be more and more important to us as far as looking down the road. Programming in each of these agreements allows different, expands options for students for advising and academic services if they choose to participate in athletic games, practice center, rec center, those sort of things. There's options built into that. They also pay for those services and free services as our students do so. But the main point is to try and expose these students, these 2-year students, to the 4-year opportunity here with WKU. I think that will help us in the region throughout Kentucky, and we're very excited about Bill White here, November 10th, signing the most recent agreement. A lot of times the community college is actually advising the different panel that is here at a 4-year institution, and we're going to try to, part of that buying these agreements, we'll work with them in those areas and making sure that they're on track to take the work they need. Have that seamless transfer into their day. So again, this is goodwill. It's also the enrollment of transfer students, and this is the right kind of work to do.
I believe we have 6, or will have 6, when we sign the agreement in November with Elizabethtown Community and Technical College. Most recently, we signed the agreement with Bowling Green Tech. And prior to that, we've initiated agreements with Hopkinsville Community and Technical College, Madisonville, Henderson, and Owensboro. So we are connecting in joint admissions in the joint admissions context with the primary KCTCS feeder institutions to WKU, where most of our transfer students from Community and Technical College come from. Of course, Glasgow, we're the principal, and there is not a KCTCS institution in Glasgow. Bowling Green Tech has some programs at Glasgow, but we're the both the full four-year, the two-year and the four-year provider principally in Glasgow. So where we have regional campuses, we certainly wanted to nail down joint admissions agreements with the Community and Technical colleges that are not only located there, but feed into to those communities as well. To the extent that we can plant the seed of completion of a baccalaureate degree in the minds of a community or technical college student in their first year or two, is the extent that we can begin to drive up those graduation rates, both for us and for KCTCS. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, sir.
I have one more information item. I promise to be brief. Very important changes occurred this year at CPE regarding their processes for approval of new academic programs and review of existing academic programs. It's summarized in page 6 of your packet. Let me give you the Cliff Notes version. The process at this time involves not only internal approval through the university, through various curricular committees, the Senate, the Provost Office, leading to this board, but also we have to post our intent for a new proposal on a CPE website, and anyone may comment on that proposal. And then following that is a full proposal submitted to CPE, and if that's approved, the program is implemented. After it's been implemented, the ongoing review has been somewhat ad hoc. This is an unpredictable timescale. The process that CPE adopted at its meeting last month allows us to post on the CPE website in parallel with our internal review process, which expedites things somewhat. And notably, only the provost of the institutions can comment on the proposal. And the intent is to resolve issues of possible duplication and so on during that 45-day period. So then, when the full proposal is invited, after any issues have been resolved, the proposal is assessed solely on its academic merit, addressing issues such as relevance to the mission, student demand, career opportunities, curriculum, faculty resources, library resources, cost effectiveness, course delivery modes, and so on. And we believe this is very helpful in allowing us to present proposals forward. In fact, we're going to pilot this new program with the new form with our DPT program, which we hope to bring to the board here in January. This will be the first program, we believe, in the Commonwealth to be submitted to CPE through this new process. Equally importantly, once a program is in place, there will be a post-implementation review, which occurs after a number of years, depending on the level of the program, associate, baccalaureate, master's, or doctoral, following which CPE will simply receive copies of our own internal review process. We review programs internally every 6 years at WKU, and we will simply share pertinent information from those reviews with CPE in a regular manner. And that will be the nature of the ongoing review by CPE. So we believe this is a much more streamlined process, which allows us to present programs in a quicker way, a more efficient way, and a more rigorous way. And again, we will be submitting the Doctor of Physical Therapy program to pilot this process early next year.
That's outlined on page 6 of your meeting booklet, the program approval and review process. So you can keep that in your records if you want to track how new academic programs are approved by CPE. And of course, they start here. Well, actually, they start in the departments, but the approval process starts here.
That's right.
Any questions for Gordon?
We'll next turn to the executive committee items. Is there any board member that desires to remove an item from the agenda? Not hearing any objection, we'll now turn to information update.
Thank you so much. There is a very brief summary in the back of and I would break it down so you have a little more interesting information about where money comes from. But I have some additional good news. Another $2 million commitment was documented this week, which means our total of $189 million is now $191. I can't reveal at this point who the donor is, but I will have that announcement later. But things are moving well. We also have our combined endowments now, according to our Vice President for Finance, are at $114,450,379. So we're moving slowly toward $200 million. Any questions?
You see highlights on page 12.
Yes. This shows that things are going, still moving well. We're ahead of pace, so hopefully we'll be celebrating with you next September.
Thank you, Catherine.
That concludes the executive. We turn now to finance and budget.
I'll direct your attention to page to the finance and committee action items. Are there any questions, or does any member want to remove any either item 3.1 or 3.2?
Mr. Porter?
Yes.
I had a question about something on item 3.2, which is personnel actions.
Okay.
Say that we do now.
I think we'll
discuss it at this point, or we just proceed.
We decide to pull them all back up at one time, or at this point.
Just make your discussion.
I'm good with that.
Okay. Leave the discussion on this.
Okay.
Debbie, you want to come?
I think that you do have one additional new item. I would go ahead and discuss it now.
Okay. Go ahead, ma'am.
Okay. Concerning item 3.2, which is personnel actions on page 3 of item 3.2, I simply had a question about the $17,000 proposed salary increase, a supplemental payment for Dr. Gordon Bayless, who's the Vice President for Research, and I just wanted to have on the record why that is coming to the board at this particular date.
Because the board has to see that which goes through the foundation. And his terms of agreement, and that was shared with the board a couple of weeks ago. Board asked, the chairman asked that we circulate that to the board.
Okay. So going forward, since this is a part of the hiring agreement, does that mean that going forward, if such supplemental payments are to be made, that in the cycle it's going to be hitting this at the fourth quarterly meeting every year? Is that when it's going to be approved, posted?
The exact amount will vary based on performance.
Right.
So therefore, you close out the old fiscal year to determine what the supplemental amount will be. So I would anticipate that it'll always be hitting for us at this meeting.
Right, so fourth quarterly committees and then...
Yes.
It's 1% of indirect cost recovery, so that number will vary. from year to year.
Right.
So it would be included on these actions, I would presume, at this, yes, this time of year.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for clarifying for the record.
And while some, you know, a letter of appointment can be perceived to be a contract, although the board has expressed an interest in reducing the number of actual contracts, formal contracts, with senior executive officers. That was a term of Dr. Bayless's appointment as vice president for research to provide that incentive for research activity. So yeah, it would show up in here as a for board approval as part of the personnel action this time of year.
Okay. So, and any future agreements made with anyone would follow that same form. You'd close the books at the end of the fiscal year, and that, and calculate any kind of supplemental payment. That means it's going to hit in the fourth quarter, right? Okay. Thank you.
Does any are there any other members who have a question or want either items 3.1 or 3.2 move for discussion or question? If not, we have one item that didn't come through committee, item 3.3, action item 3.3, which is the first quarter statement of revenues and expenditures on page 15. And Ann Mead is here to present that.
As we discussed at committee, we have a timing issue related to giving you current financial information. The first quarter is obviously July 1 to September 30th, which doesn't, and it takes a week to 10 days to actually close out a quarter. We're changing our procedure because I didn't want to hold first quarter financial information to a late finance and budget committee, so this makes it a more timely report to the board. Though it's not possible really to run it through committee. So the first quarter report is on pages 15 and 16, consistent with Dr. Meredith's report on enrollment. I can tell you that I was very pleased to see us meet budget this week on our fall tuition revenue projection. So that means that the reinstatement process is working well, and we will probably have a slight surplus on the revenue side for fall tuition, consistent with what I'm hearing. It aligns well. That's the last page of your agenda book. For some newer members of the board, perhaps I ought to explain that. Even though the first quarter is 25% of the fiscal year, your revenue and expenses in some categories don't necessarily align with 25%. There is nothing to be concerned about in this quarterly report. However, if you think about tuition and fees, we truly want to see our tuition and fees for fall come in first quarter as best as possible. So therefore, what you see, you'll have a bump in tuition revenue essentially August and September. You'll have a bump in tuition revenue in January and February. So the deposit of tuition and fees obviously don't occur in an equal amount in every month. So that's why you see 48% rather than perhaps 25% of your tuition and fees in the first quarter. Your state appropriation is slightly higher than 25% of our state appropriation. The Commonwealth of Kentucky has a formula for distributing our state appropriation, and it's not on an equal amount per quarter. So this is as expected. When I give you an assessment of the financial health of the institution, the two most important components are obviously the tuition and fees and enrollment, and the state appropriation. So we're on target for budget for tuition and fees. And in terms of state appropriations, we have no indications out of Frankfurt as of this point that there would be any adjustments in our state funding. So that's positive news. The other revenue sources, again, may come in sporadically. Grants and contracts may not be very predictable of when you'll actually get an award assigned and when you spend the funds. However, in the most of our programs, other than those that are supported by our central tuition and our state appropriation, don't spend money unless they have it, and they are program administrators, so we're not at risk for running deficits in those programs that are especially supported by restricted funds. Lastly, I can also tell you, even though it says grants and contracts, student financial aid, Pell grants. So this doesn't mean that we have $32 million in extramural support. Our Pell grants, SEO grants are in that number. So that number runs a little higher for the same reason as tuition and fees. But in restricted funds, as it relates to grants and contracts or programs we call revenue dependent, they are self-generating. They're very good at managing their resources so that they don't expend more than the revenue they bring in. Does anyone have any questions?
Okay. Did I hear a motion that this be this report be accepted by the board?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All opposed? All for?
Aye.
Aye.
Everybody was unanimous. Passes.
Let me just take this moment to tell you that on one of your other agenda items, we will sell bonds on October 26th. So I'll have a report at the next committee meeting on the sale of bonds, and it looks good.
Thank you. That concludes.
Before we turn to student affairs, we have now presented all the action items. So it would be appropriate to entertain a motion to accept action items out of academic affairs. Executive committee and the finance and budget committee.
So moved.
Second.
Motion made by Dr. Minner, seconded by Mr. Meyer. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The consent action items are adopted. Next, we turn to the Student Affairs Committee.
Howard. In your committee meetings last month, we gave you a update on our housing and meal plan status, and as of today, we want to give you a much more firm number in terms of where we stand in our residential living and our meal plan. I'll cover the residential living, and Mr. Osman will cover the meal plan. As you will see in your packet, our freshman and transfer students are up over 100 students. Our returning freshmen, and that would be those students who have less than 30 hours obtained during their first year here, is also up by over 300 students. We're down in sophomores, but we're down in sophomores because we released sophomores with outstanding academic performance in order to make room for the additional first-year students that we took in during the summer. Excuse me. Our junior and senior numbers are also down, but we have a increase above our last year number by well over 100, and we have a full capacity of 4927 total number of beds. I want to share with you that we also have some private rooms
due to students' medical conditions, and so we are right at full capacity this year.
At our January meeting, you'll hear from our Student Life Foundation, but I just would remind the board that given the debt service obligations of the Student Life Foundation, we our target to meet though that business pro forma is about 92%, as I understand it.
Correct.
That we need to have in order to meet debt service payments on residence halls. So obviously, we're way above that number. So anything we generate above and beyond the required debt service payment gives the Student Life Foundation and the Office of Housing and Residence Life the opportunity to have cash flow that goes right back into those residence halls.
That allows us to do maintenance and renovation earlier than the scheduled plan, and is allowing us to go into constructing new housing that we, as I stated earlier, that we're paying for as we go. So we will, when we turn key next fall, we will have no debt on the new housing that we are constructing.
This is a matter of question for my own self. When a student has a single room, no roommate, what's the difference in cost versus
The student who has a private room, they pay 1.5 times of what that other student would have paid. Of course, as I said, there are some students that, because of their disability and because of the design of the room, they're in a single occupancy room that was built and constructed for all one that, student. Yeah.
So
that would be an exception.
Might also add that the housing rates last year to this year, no residence hall exceeded a rate increase above 3%.
Yeah.
And so that's a remarkable business plan with the Student Life Foundation to manage those properties and keep costs well in check. Comparatively speaking,
our pro forma was set at 5% increase each year, but we have not had to do so.
What's the status? You mentioned that when we turn key on the new housing next fall, that it'll be debt free. What is the status on the new housing at this point?
It's under construction.
Okay, how many students will be housed?
72.
72 students,
yes.
Total. And how's that fractioned out? Like, how many people per apartment?
Two students per apartment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
And that's the wrap around the parking garage.
Right.
And we'll
yes,
begin
sir.
The work across the street next.
We hope to start next spring across the street
on the
Kentucky Street side.
Yeah.
Okay.
But if you'll, you pass that area now, you'll see the footers have gone in, and the wall that separates the apartment buildings from the parking structure are in process now also.
Okay.
So we're taking advantage of fall weather and making good progress.
Hope it stays nice.
Yeah.
Any questions on housing? John?
Editorial comment first would be that housing and dining are essential student services that contribute significantly to the quality of life on campus. And when we are visited by prospective students, these are two very highly inspected and reviewed areas. So we're quite pleased with what we've been able to do over the years with our housing and dining program. And the numbers that are here related to our meal plan programs profile for you how there is a wide variety of different plans, and that when you compare last year with this year, we are up a little, which is good. We continue to attract students to the program, you can see that the most of interest program to students is the 10, 12, and 14 meal plans. And every year it seems that we tweak the program to respond to the interest. As you might imagine, there is a great difference between what a commuter, part-time, full-time resident might have in terms of interest. So that's why there's a wide variety. In addition to these plans, you can see there are block plans that let students buy meals as a block and use them whenever they wish throughout the semester. There's also a program known as Dining Dollars and Big Red Dollars, which only add flexibility to the program and let them buy and put money on deposit and use it as a debit account, etc. So the program's doing well, and there's the numbers, and we're very pleased. I think I've also circulated a brochure with you that gives you a pretty good profile of the not only the variety of what's available in the program, but also it demonstrates the geographic locations and the way they're distributed. There was a time on this campus, not that too many years ago, where food was really limited to two locations, and we have worked hard at finding ways to distribute food locations throughout the campus, north, south, east, and west. Or we've got dining at various places. It's worked out well. It's only complemented the program, and the brochure does a good way of illustrating graphically what we have.
Yeah, just one question, slight observation, I guess. With the renovation of Downing Student Union, how much additional pressure will that put on the other dining venues?
Well, during the construction phase, where we're going to have to, obviously, at parts of the time, reduce the food capacity at Downing Center, it's going to put significant demand on other locations, and we're going to have to be creative in coming up with ways to put food in other locations, which we're working on right now.
Very good.
Yeah, clearly the facilities in the Downing University Center are the most active in terms of student use and faculty staff as well, but mainly student use. So finding that alternative swing space while that facility is being renovated is going to be a significant set of actions, and maintaining this business plan is going to be a challenge while that renovation occurs. And student convenience, just to access the options.
Glad we got a plan.
Coming
we don't want to get you all hungry.
No. Well,
that's all
thoughts,
we have, I guess. This any questions for these gentlemen?
Outside of feeding the mind, feeding the rest of the bodies, and sleeping the rest of it, is pretty important to students. So any thoughts on either of these things?
It's good enough for me.
I really commend our staff in both areas. We do a great job of sustaining a high quality of life for our students and keeping prices in check, and the same thing with meal plans.
We've been averaging 3%.
No meal plan exceeded 3% in cost increases this year, and that's an impressive constraint on pricing.
That is, Jim.
As far as I know, Billy, do you have any observations from the student perspective?
Homecoming, we're going to win tomorrow.
That's the best report we had all meeting.
Last item on the agenda is our other business. You note homecoming tomorrow. Commencement dates for December 16th and the 17th. And our next board meeting on January 20th. Mr. President, I think we have
I do. A few things before we adjourn. We are going to schedule, we're looking at a date, but right now we're looking at the date of the graduate commencement on December 16. Are we looking at other dates for committee meetings? We probably will come back with committee meetings. Normally in the past we have refrained from having committee meetings between the fourth quarterly fall meeting and the first winter quarterly meeting in January just because of holidays and lots of things. But I think it would be important, particularly since we're moving to a consent agenda, that we have committee meetings and not go into a board meeting without having committees address matters that come before the board at its regularly scheduled meeting. So we will be back to you shortly with what we think will be the best and most convenient recommendation for quarterly committee meetings, and that will probably be on the afternoon of Friday, December 16. So just whatever that's worth, just make that calendar note, and Julia will be following up with you. A few items that I think it's appropriate to share with the board before we adjourn. We are wrapping up our most recent internal audit and be forwarding those final responses to you shortly. Going forward, I remind the board that we will be updating you at each quarterly meeting with the internal audit activity starting in January. And as we complete the current audit, which covers an extended period of time, the January meeting will cover the first 6 months of the current fiscal year. And then going forward, from that point on, each quarterly audit report will cover the previous quarter. So we're in that transition phase of condensing our auditing functions and reporting to the board in a much more condensed timeline. And in fact, the chair has been heavily engaged, given his experience as a CPA and attorney, and working with our auditor to condense that schedule for reporting. So I just want you to be aware of that. As I mentioned a moment ago, we will be arranging presentations from all of our major foundations at the January 1st quarterly meeting of 2012. So we will have some type of what we refer to as a retreat format as we do in the summer. We will add that into the January meeting because that will be an important discussion and dialogue. As we hear from the WKU Foundation, the College Heights Foundation, the Student Life Foundation, and the Research Foundation, and those are our four primary foundations. The Hilltopper Athletic Foundation has its resources in our other foundations. So from a financial standpoint, the HAF will be included in what we do with the other foundations. So this will be a good opportunity for the board, particularly many of you that are relatively new on the board, to have a sense of how the foundations work in the life of the university and why. So we will do that in January, and we'll be back to you with an amended timeline for the January board meeting. I would also share with you that I'll be sending out information in the weeks ahead to you in writing. As we anticipate the next CPE meeting and CPE taking action on practice-based doctorates and on the higher ed budget model going into the next legislative session. Both of those things are taking shape through CPE in anticipation of this legislative session. I'll also be reporting to you some things that are taking shape in the TIF district, the Tax Incremental Financing District, as it relates to plan developments that are beginning to take shape at both ends of the TIF in Block 12, where the Alumni Conference Center and the parking structure and the student housing is taking shape. RFPs for hotel and other things are being prepared. And then at the other end of the TIF, our partnership with the Medical Center and the College of Nursing. We are resuming that discussion as we anticipate going to the legislature for long-term lease approval in that normal process this spring. And then finally, I'll be reporting to you on uses of central carry forward dollars that are now being defined. And I'm working with Vice President Meade and Vice President Emsley and the other vice presidents on uses of those central carry forward dollars. So a lot that we'll be sharing with you that is currently in the process of being defined, and we'll be back with you in the next few weeks.
Any other questions or comments, items of new business? Again, congratulations to Ms. Harris for joining us. Welcome aboard. If there's nothing else, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Make a motion that we adjourn.
Excuse me. I asked that this be circulated. Let me pass this around. This is a faculty staff emergency procedures handbook. It's important for the board to keep track of what we do in the event of a campus emergency, and that's being circulated to all academic and administrative departments currently. So the police department and student affairs do a terrific job in all of the campus and making sure that we're always prepared for the unexpected.
I did notice that in reviewing the information that was sent out regarding the crime statistics on campus, what a tremendous 25% yep. decrease in
yep.
crime on campus. It was already a low number, and obviously that's a really, John was talking about earlier, when you have parents visiting on campus, and that's one of the major concerns they have, is how safe is that young person on campus.
Julia's
right up there with where they eat and where they sleep, isn't it?
Yes, sir. Great job. Great job.
Any instructions for us on the luncheon today?
Those of you who are attending, you have reserved seating, so as soon as you go in, they'll direct you to where you need to be. It's at the University Plaza.
That begins at 11:30, yes. So if you can arrive at 11:15 or so, and then you're invited to come by the Phelps Cabin this afternoon at 4 to enjoy company with vice presidents, deans, and our spirit masters who are having a reunion there as well, and watch the homecoming parade and enjoy homecoming weekend. And we got lots going throughout the day tomorrow, so enjoy homecoming weekend 2011. Excuse me.
I have a motion from Regent Kennedy, and I need a second to adjourn.
So moved. So,
seconded by Patty. Any objection? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. We're adjourned.